Welcome to Great Australian Lives.
For Tobin Brothers Funerals,
celebrating lives. Here's your host, Laura Turner.
Special edition of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. I'm Laura Turner. There's a good chance that if you haven't read a book by our guest tonight, your kids or grandkids probably have, with titles like Far Out Brussels Sprout, All Right Vegemite, and Unreal Banana Peel, considered classics of modern Australian children's literature. She's also a well-known and highly respected folklorist and social historian. Her new book, Soldiers and Aliens, explores some of the lesser-known stories from World War II, shedding light on a critical period of Australian history. It is my pleasure to welcome June Factor to Great Australian Lives. Welcome to you, Dr. Factor. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine, thank you. And it's very pleasing to be on your program, but please just call me June.
I shall. Thank you, June. Now, look, congratulations on the new book, Soldiers and Aliens. Certainly different to some of the other titles that I read out in the intro there. And those, of course, are your children's books. But it was your father's story that inspired this one, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Before I explain that, I should say I've never quite understood why a writer should only be able to do one thing. And I've always had a range of interests, childhood and children's language and culture being one. But other forms of history and human life interest me too. Yes, my father came from Poland just before the Second World War, and then brought over his wife and infant child. He was very far-sighted and took Hitler seriously. Now, you'd imagine that everybody was taking Hitler seriously in the late 30s. Mm. But a lot of people, I mean, people lead their busy lives. And politicians apparently lead busy and often foolish lives because there was somewhat of a view that while Hitler was bad, and he was probably mad, a lot of people thought he was mad, and there he is rearming madly, but the idea of a war, and particularly Poland, which was an ally of Germany, that seemed, you know, for a lot of people, that they didn't see a danger. And, of course, there was danger, and my father did see it. And he came to Australia, the other side of the world, and he knew nobody here.
Incredible. And loved Australia.
I'm not sure that he loved it from the very first minute. I quote something that he said. He came to Melbourne, and he went to the Victoria Market, and he saw people, very poor people, scrabbling for food in the thrown out bits of the, you know, where the food is a bit rotten. And he thought to himself how extraordinary, because he came from poverty in Poland. And he thought how extraordinary that I travel to the other side of the world. And there it is again.
It's very telling of those years, wasn't it? And he'd only been in Australia for 3 years before war arrived. What exactly is meant by his status as a friendly alien?
Right. Well, he came in 38 and the war breaks out in 39. But the companies that he went into, the alien employment companies, aren't established until about 42. Mm. So there's a period there where he gets a job. Well, I'm not sure that you can say that he got a job. He was advised that what you need to do... Remember, he had no English, none at all. But he had a beautiful tenor voice, so it was very musical. That wasn't really very useful. He was advised to go to Coles and to buy some very cheap jewellery, you know, pennies and sort of jewellery, which, interestingly enough, before the war was always Japanese. They made the cheap jewellery. And you take that and then you go and knock on people's doors. You hope that a woman will come to the door and that you can persuade her somehow to buy, you know, a brooch or whatever it was and give you some money.
How are you persuading if you can't speak English?
He had some really interesting experiences in that period of his life too.
I can well imagine. Was it Japanese when he was doing it?
Yes, all the trinkets, the very cheap trinkets in Coles, were all made in Japan. I remember the war hadn't broken out yet, so they were still. I don't know whether Coles got rid of it all its Japanese products when the war was on. That would be an interesting question to ask.
Yeah, that's why I was asking. But yeah, as you say, it was just before the war, so maybe that happened later on. How did he go with these sales, having not spoken English?
Well, I'm not sure how he went
with his tenor
exactly
voice.
With the sales. Not, I would imagine, terribly well. I think it would be sympathy.
Yes.
That would make you, when somebody comes to the door with these little cheap things and clearly can't speak practically any English, it would be sympathy
yes.
that makes you buy a pair of earrings or a bracelet. But on one occasion, when he, that must have been summer, I think, and the main door was open, just the wire door, and he could hear someone singing an aria from an opera. Now, I kick myself these days because I think I must once have asked him what was the aria, but I don't remember anymore. But it was one of the great, probably one of the Italian operas. Mm. Now, my father loved opera and knew these operas and had a very good voice as well. So when the woman came to the door, instead of opening his little bag of Japanese trinkets, he named the aria of the opera. She was, I think, a bit startled. But she invited him in. And it turned out that she and her husband were music teachers, singing teachers, at the Melbourne Conservatorium, but they also gave lessons at home. And they had one of their students there who they were giving a lesson to. Somehow music is an international language.
Mm.
Somehow they got my father to sing. And somehow they made him understand that they would give him lessons.
Ah.
And he shook his head no. So they must have thought, probably very accurately, that he couldn't afford lessons.
Yes.
So they made it clear to him that they weren't going to charge him.
Oh.
But he still shook his head no, because he had to earn money to bring his little family out.
Yes.
And so he never had. I've often thought, what a different life my father might have had.
Yes, absolutely.
Had he been able to have those opera classes.
Yeah. It's beautiful to hear that he came across some wonderfully charitable people to a person who, you know, just turned up at the door wanting them to buy something from him. It's lovely to hear
those things.
Yeah.
I think the world is full of kindness as well as cruelty.
Absolutely. Now, it took your dad a few attempts to get into the army, didn't it? He had to really prove that he was worthy of being enlisted.
Tell me
how he did that.
Well, by that time, of course, his little family was here. And he was an anti-fascist from way back. Mm. And so he made an attempt to join the army, and I think they knocked him back. So he turned to a number of the more leading figures in the Jewish community in Melbourne and got them, I don't know how willingly, and got them to sign a collective letter offering to join. And this time the response was yes. And that's how he joined.
Absolutely beautiful. It's so good to hear that he was able to achieve that, given all the hurdles that he had faced. Now, the enjoyment companies, you dedicate a whole chapter in the book to the enjoyment companies. Can you explain that more?
Well, maybe I should just say a word about the part of the army that he goes into.
Mm.
It was called the employment companies. I think initially the government had given it the name, or the army, no, it would have been the government, I think, actually, that had given it the name Labour Companies.
Mm.
That got changed very quickly to Employment Companies. I never in my research found out why they changed the name, but perhaps Labour wasn't dignified enough, and employment is a word with many syllables. And these were soldiers in every respect, uniform, saluting, marching, the whole discipline, the wages and so on, but they were not armed. And their job was to do the hard labour that was absolutely essential for the military to survive. You've got to remember that at that period, and for many years later, I might say, the trains in Australia all had to stop at the border of their state, because while all of Australia was settled, European settlement, by people coming from the British Isles, they all had chose different railway gauges. So you couldn't go from Victoria to New South Wales, for example, or the other way, without getting off at the border and then waiting for another train that would take you further on. There was no lines covered state borders. And this is an inconvenience and a nuisance in peacetime. But in wartime, when you are desperately trying to send men and armaments and goods up north, this was very serious. So the men, one of their major jobs was loading and unloading trains. And the irony was that they were often unloading ammunition, bombs, guns, everything. And yet the men in the employment companies, despite their wish to learn to shoot, were never given guns.
Fascinating stuff. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals Celebrating Lives. Our guest tonight is June Factor, and in a moment we'll find out about June's early years and the influences that saw her pursue her love of writing and history.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals Celebrating Lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funeral Celebrating Lives. I'm Laura Turner. Our guest tonight is June Factor, author of much-loved children's books, Far Out Brussels Sprout, All Right Vegemite and Unreal Banana Peel, among many others, of course. Her latest book is Soldiers and Aliens, a bit of a different one, which explores the stories of men in the Australian Army's employment companies during World War II. We were just talking with June about the fact her dad was in one of those companies and obviously is the inspiration for this book. June, do you know how did he come out of his service and war? We know so many from that generation were deeply affected for many, many years to come. How was your dad?
Oh, I think my dad was fine. Remember, he's not sent overseas.
Yes, and didn't have a gun.
Much to their chagrin, they don't shoot guns. Mm. They do work for... all of them, including my father, who was not very tall and not very a very slight build, they all come out much more muscular than they go in, because they're doing this heavy lifting. They may not be able to fire weaponry, but they're lifting it and carting it around. They're digging. Sometimes they're called on to go onto the wharves and help the wharfies. I have a horrible feeling that at least on one occasion, it was probably more than once, they were actually used as strike breakers.
Oh, wow.
If the wharfies had gone on strike, they brought the soldiers in to do the loading and unloading. I suppose the major argument for that was that it was a war.
Yeah,
but,
absolutely.
So they, on the whole, and they took men. I mean, they took men with flat feet, and they took men who didn't have very good eyesight and so on. It was not nearly as severe a sort of perfection, of physical perfection, that was required for this part of the army.
Yes.
And on the whole, most of them became a lot fitter.
Yeah, well, I can well imagine that. You interviewed several servicemen for the book and received a lot of material from their families. I can imagine you would have come across some incredible experiences and stories researching the book. So many personal stories untold.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, it was. I mean, it was a great gift to me from the families and sometimes from the men themselves, because it's been quite a long process. And I started off, I'm very glad I did, I started off by trying to find men who had been in the employment companies to interview them. And I found quite a number, and they were very generous. So I sat in, I visited people in their homes, and by this time, of course, their grandfathers and you know, getting on in years. And for some of them, I came to realise that it was the first time they had ever talked to anybody about their war experiences outside of generalities since they were in the army. I mean, people's lives take different shapes and different, you know, different experiences. And for some, for a few, this was, my appearance was actually something they welcomed in a way that I hadn't expected.
Yes.
In that, at last, here is somebody who is interested in a part of my life which I have largely hidden.
Yes, and that generation was sort of not encouraged to talk about it, and it was a generation that where feelings and emotions weren't as openly discussed as they are now. So I can imagine that many of those gentlemen would have been like opening the floodgates.
Yes, and I think also it was the times that after the war, everybody needed to start afresh, you know, they wanted to make a life.
Move on.
They had to go. One of the interesting sections in the book is about what happens towards the end of the war, because the army doesn't just open the gates, as it were, all at once and says, everybody out now.
Of course.
The people are released gradually. And what's more, so one of the really great pleasures of when I was writing this book was to discover how remarkable the army had been in terms of education and culture. Here is this, you know, bitter, difficult, absolutely, you know, life-determining war, but they have a wonderful education section. There were a lot of soldiers, not just in the employment companies, but more widely. Australia before the war didn't have a high education standard. There were people who were conscripted into the army who could not read and write. And that was more likely to be not in the employment companies, but outside in the more general. So they have a whole education section. They publish a marvellous little sort of journal called SALT, from the idea of pass round the salt, which has got articles and cartoons and soldiers write for it. I mean, you know, there's much of great interest that I came across, and there's some of that is in the book.
Incredible. And speaking of lives and how people came to be and their education, I want to talk about you. You were born in Lodz, have I pronounced that correctly, in Poland?
That's how I pronounce it. I don't think the Poles pronounce it like that.
Tell me how.
It's spelled L-O-D. They do something funny to the letter L.
Right.
I was an infant.
Yes.
And so I was 2 years old, and I was speaking quite fluently Polish.
Yes, yes.
But I have no, you know, except for a few phrases now,
yes.
I'm afraid.
That's tragic, isn't it? But you came to Melbourne at the age of two.
It was my father's conviction that dangerous times were afoot. He took Hitler seriously and persuaded my mother. He was a very persuasive man, my father.
Yes.
So they came to Australia. They had no English. I remember my mother told a story. She knew nothing about Australia. So she asked a friend of hers who had an atlas to look up Australia. And the friend dutifully did this. And the result was, Australia is very hot. It is made up of people with very dark skins. And I think those were the two major bits of information this particular atlas provided.
How old was the atlas?
For Australia. yes. The very first day that she arrived was also the day there was great bushfires in around Melbourne. And ash was falling in the city. And so she comes here, leaving everybody behind, with her infant child, her husband. husband greets her. He'd found somewhere to live in Carlton. In those days, Carlton in Melbourne, I don't know how many of your listeners know Carlton, but now Carlton is a very prosperous suburb.
Yes.
But in those days, it was working class
yes.
and immigrant.
Yes, absolutely.
And they'd found somewhere to live, and ash is falling from the sky.
Gosh, how very Australian.
As a welcome, how very unfortunate.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah,
I mean. I remember my mother telling me, of course, when I was many years later as an adult, that in those early years she cried quietly at night for a long time after my father was asleep. You know, everybody that she knew, she was no longer around her, except her sister, because her older sister came out at the same time. Mm. And she had never learned to cook. Mm. Because she'd gone to work at about the age of 12.
Mm-hmm.
And now she was left at home with the infant to cook. And I do remember a story which she always denied, but the family enjoyed. She decided to make hard-boiled eggs, so she cooked them for 2 hours. but she became a wonderful cook. By the time I knew her, she was fantastic.
That is a very hard-boiled egg. Now, you had a love of books and scribbled stories at a young age. When did that turn into, a possible career path for you?
My first publication was, I was about 11. There was some organisation, I don't remember the name or anything, that was running a short story competition for, and actually it was international in some way.
Mm.
Unfortunately, I don't remember what I wrote, and I wrote a short story, and I won a prize. I didn't win the prize, but I won a prize. I still have two wonderful Chinese prints hanging on the wall in my study that I won at the age of, I think, 11 for a short story. I wish I still had it, the story, I mean.
Yes, absolutely. Those things are always fascinating to look back and read. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals Celebrating Lives. Our guest tonight is author, folklorist and social historian June Factor. Plenty more with June in just a moment.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals Celebrating Lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals Celebrating Lives. Our guest tonight is June Factor, writer and honorary senior fellow, School of Historical and Philosophical Studies at the University of Melbourne, among many other things. And I know just for the children of Australia, she's just a very much loved writer. And I shouldn't say just, she's part of story time, bedtime for so many kids. And that is because of some of those incredible books that she has written, Far Out, Russell Sprout, All Right, Vegemite, Roll Over, Pavlova. One of my daughters loves Pavlova. Unreal Banana Peel, all of those incredible books. Now, June, you've got a special interest in children's folklore and language. And in 1996, you released your book called Kidspeak. In the blurb, it highlights that by the time you're 5 or 6, children have learnt to explain, complain, admire, speculate, imagine, inquire, agree, argue and shock in their mother tongue. What made you write about that, and what's the fascination?
Well, as you can see, this is even from small childhood, I was obviously interested in stories.
Yes. Mm.
And you need to also remember, and there may be some of your listeners of my advanced age who will also remember from their childhood, we didn't have lending libraries. You know, schools didn't lend libraries. Schools, actually, primary schools at least, didn't have libraries. I spent my early youth in a state of sort of book hunger. So I think, from very early on, I was enormously delighted. My relatives would say to me, you know, darling, what would you like for your birthday? And my answer was always the same, a book. Mm. And they would end up giving me a petticoat.
Oh, you'd be bitterly disappointed. Yes. Do you know, June Factor, my mother has kept a letter that I wrote when I was seven to the council when I lived out on Mount Dandenong and Alinda. I wrote to the Shire because they were going to take away, because we were a bit remote, we used to have a library van that would come. We didn't have a building. We had a big bus or big that would come and, you know, you'd on a special day once a month or whatever, and they were going to take it away. They were defunding it and they were going to take it away. And I was the same as you, loved reading, loved writing. So I wrote a letter and this made this campaign. I think this was the beginning of my career as a journalist to bring back the library van or stop it from being taken away. And I won. And she still has the letter of little Laura, 7 years old, saying, please don't take away my library van. And they didn't. And it's still to this day, 31 years later, still returns to the same spot. I drive past it when I go and visit my mum. And that is a sense of pride
Bravo,
for me.
Laura,
little
well
Laura
done.
With her glasses on and her love of language and writing. I was a girl after your own heart, June Factor. Loved the written word and still do.
Well, I must tell you, because, you know, we're talking about Melbourne here. One of the things I discovered by about the age, I think, of 9 or 10, and I now don't remember how I discovered this, is that Myers, you know, the great big store in the city, had a lending library.
Wow.
And it had a lending library for adults. And it had also a children's section.
Wow.
We lived in Carlton.
Would have been close for you.
I must have got onto a tram very early. I would catch the tram that ran from Carlton into the city. It go into Myers. They had very strict rules. You were only allowed to borrow 2 books a fortnight. And you could. It was a full fortnight. So if you arrived 20 minutes before the end of your fortnight, you had to wait.
Oh.
But this was, you know, 2 books for a child a week is not much nourishment. Luckily, I had a cousin who also went to the library. To Myers Library.
Yes.
And so once I'd read my 2 books, I would walk all the way up to the other end of Carlton, actually, and read her 2 books.
I love that. God, what different times we're in now.
Thankfully, with my own children, I made sure we moved when they were quite young to where I live now. And one of the things I looked for was a nearby library.
Yes, good on you.
That was there.
Yeah, I've got to inject myself into this again. I have instilled reading to my children since the moment they were born, because I love, and that it's always said that they're about a year ahead in the way that they speak, because I put it down to reading to them so much, you know, 3 or 4 books before they go to bed every night, and they speak so well. Because I think I did it selfishly, June, because I wanted them to be able to communicate with me, to tell me what's wrong when they were sick or, you know, upset. Because when they were babies, I think, oh, I wish you could just tell me. So I thought I'm gonna force this language thing. And they're such good speakers now.
Well, it is a lifetime gift to give your children
to communicate.
When you do this.
Yeah, that's right.
Absolutely. Yeah. It is. But I have a funny story to tell you. At one point, one of my children was in hospital, and I used to go in. He'd had terrible croup and so on, and they'd had to operate on his throat. So for a while, he couldn't speak. He was very, very good. He was only about 8, I think. And I would go in every day and read to him. And I discovered, at first I just didn't take much notice of it, but first one nurse and then after a day or two, 2 nurses found something very quiet to do in the corner of the room
they were
while
loving
I was
to
reading
every
day.
Oh.
And I forget the name of the author now, a marvellous Australian author. I'm embarrassed that I can't think of his name. Yes. It was a terrific novel.
Yes.
And I was reading a chapter every day.
They were listening.
They came to hear it too.
Lovely. Oh, Makes me want to cry. Now, you wrote Kid Speak.
For joy, really.
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
Yes.
What in terms of your book, Kid Speak, and that, which explores inventive and sometimes crude and witty, amazing ways that children communicate, has your analysis, your observation in the 18 years since you wrote that book, has the way they speak and communicate changed?
Oh, yes and no. I mean, the basis of it doesn't change. That is the marvellous inventiveness, the vividness, the experimentation with language. That is absolutely one of the joys and one of the, I think, probably the necessities of children, that they play with it as they play with other things. Mm. And in the process of playing with it, they both master it, but also gain a wonderful flexibility and of language here. And I mean, there is no culture that I have been able to find in the world where the children don't play games, where they don't have rhymes and riddles and sayings and insults and magic and all of that. Mm. It is part of the nature, of the very rich cultural nature of being human.
I love it.
And I found it fascinating. And so you get, you know, Mary had a little lamb, her father shot it dead. Now it goes to school with her between two chunks of bread. I mean, you know...
I've not heard that version before. That must be the Outback Sheep Station version.
You don't know that one.
No. Oh, the poor lamb.
I mean, that's why when I did Far Out Brussels Sprout, one book was not enough.
Yes.
Because there's so many.
Yes.
It is a marvellously rich, and of course there's other parts of children's play culture, the actual games they play, the varieties.
Yes.
There are so many varieties of hopscotch.
Yes.
The
yes.
shape that they build, yeah. the rules that are there. When a child goes from one school to another, it's not just the rules of the school that the new child has to learn. It's the rules of the playground as well.
Yes, I love watching, just standing back at my children's bedroom door quietly and watching them making up games and playing, you know, with their unicorns and making up stories. It's beautiful to watch.
Yes.
This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives. Our guest tonight is June Factor, and we'll wrap things up with June in just a moment.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives. I'm Laura Turner. Our guest tonight is June Factor, author of much-loved children's books Far Out Brussels Sprout, All Right Vegemite, and Unreal Banana Peel, among many others. Her latest book is Soldiers and Aliens, which explores the stories of men in the Australian Army's employment companies during World War II. But for you, June Factor, what's next? What does the rest of 2022 entail for you?
That's an interesting question, Laura. I don't think I've got much past the fact that there's a launch on Saturday. The book has been such a dominant part of my life. I mean, I still have gone to the theatre and concerts when we're allowed to, you know, wearing masks, of course. But we haven't been able to travel or do any of those sorts of things. Mm. I haven't really much thought about it. You would appreciate, I think, one of the thoughts I was having yesterday in the cold, that really it would be very nice to be somewhere north,
yes.
somewhere in Queensland at this moment.
It's been cold, I think, to be warmer. Yes,
that's right. I have no plans in particular.
Well, isn't that nice?
I can't imagine that I'll stop writing, but what that will be. I think the book has been a very, very happily major work. Mm. I did a lot of interviewing. I did a massive amount of research. Mm. Then you've got to write it, of course.
And then rewrite it.
So it's taken up a significant part of my life for some years. And after the launch, then I've got some speaking engagements. You know, people want, you know, organisations want you to come and speak. And I do that very readily because I'm very happy to talk about the book I want people to know about this rather hidden part.
Mm.
And all of these men were aliens, were foreigners.
Mm.
They made a real contribution to the Australian military in the Second World War, but they're very little known.
Mm.
And it's time they were known and honoured.
I love that, June. And I love that we're still finding out, you know, these unknown stories and little pockets of information about a deeply explored world event such as a world war. But there's still little stories and little things that we don't know. And it's beautiful to see, that we're still finding those things out.
Indeed.
Yes.
I agree.
Is there any more that you might write about? Any other things you found along the way that could perhaps make another?
Oh, as I say, at the moment that part is a blank, a blank page ahead of me, because it's been a great joy for me to do, as well as a great labour.
Yes.
And now I have to sort of live with it for quite a while people, people ask me to speak to them about it, and there are interviews and all of that, and I'm delighted to do that, all of that. But there will come a point at which I will be once again, in a sense, the author of another book, but not tied to it as closely as I am tied to it now.
Mm.
And then, perhaps, I'll be thinking of what else to write. But at the moment, I'm a gloriously blank slate.
I love it. I can imagine there'd probably be a period of falling in a heap and just resting after such an enormous body of work. June Factor, thank you so much for being on the show with us tonight. It has been an educational and very interesting experience. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure for me to talk to you, Laura. Thank you.
And June's book, Soldiers and Aliens, is in store now through Melbourne University Press. And of course, if you've enjoyed our chat with June Factor tonight and you'd like to share it with a friend, subscribe to the Great Australian Lives podcast and make sure you never miss an episode. And join me the same time next week when we celebrate another great Australian life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives.